Loud gavel. I just wanted to call the Conference Committee on Senate File 2065 to order. Thanks a lot for coming and joining us here today. We'd like to be efficient with the use of our time here. There's a couple of issues that we'll have to probably spend a little bit of time discussing here today. But before we get into that, I'd just like to maybe go around the table real quick just for brief introductions for those of us who may not know each other. I'm Matt Schmidt. I hail from Red Wing and in my first term here. And this is my bill. We ran it through the Senate committees and began with Senator Sparks. Seems like just yesterday. So.
Right. Dan Sparks from Austin, Minnesota.
Representative Tim Mahoney from east side of St. Paul.
Representative John Ward from Rainier Lakes area.
Representative Bob Gunther from Fairmont.
Well, that said, perhaps we could pass the conversation over to Senate Counsel if they'd like to run us through provisions here. And what we'll do today is plan on doing just the side-by-sides here, and then also maybe we'll get into the same and similar. So I think we're going to have to make our way out to the floor eventually here this afternoon, so we may have to recess for a bit. But we'll just start going through the bill here if we could.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I might ask, we've got at least one testifier that was here last week.
Sure.
And he's here again today, so if we can make sure that we at least hear from him on one of the particular issues in the bill.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Mahoney. We'd love to make sure that we give folks a chance to testify on each provision here today before we move on. So we'll try to make that happen. Well, that said, Mr. Fuller, would you mind?
Members, the side-by-side reflects the sort of amalgamated House amendments, and there's only one Senate File 2065, and then the local building inspector bill, which passed the Senate, has been included in your side-by-side. The first section is a House provision, and the next batch of sections is the apprenticeship provisions, which is the House. The Senate has a bill on the Senate floor at 2124 that has not received floor action, which is virtually identical to the House language. So if the House, Anita Newman would like to say anything about the House provisions until we get up to the independent contractor.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, the House Section 1 on R1 is the provision that was added as an amendment. It names the two farm organization members of the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. And then, as Mr. Fuller said, sections 2 through 13, which take you through page R14, is the House version of the apprenticeship conformity bill. And then on page R14 begins the independent contractor provisions. And I think the main difference is the Senate makes the independent contractor pilot program into a permanent ongoing program, and the Senate extends it as a pilot for a couple of more years. On page R18, in keeping with the fact that the Senate makes this a permanent program, there's language about a third of the way down the page, beginning on line at 1827, that provides for the transition of registrations under the pilot program into the permanent program. And then on page R19 and section 18 are some enforcement and penalty provisions that are in the House bill.
The League of Cities came in on page R20, and this issue has to do, the language is almost identical. It was Senate File 1926, Senator Koonin, and it was amended on to the House Companion to 2065. And what it does with respect to public building and state licensed facilities, there are some special provisions in the law about what set of circumstances would have to occur before the state would cede authority over to the local inspector. This amends that process, makes it more straightforward, more precise, and puts in the appeal process. And then it looks like there's a lot of other stuff that's done, but it's not the case. You notice the big repealer on line 120, line language stricken through it. It's replaced later on just by reorganization of the same language. So it appears it's all new language, but it's just newly located in the statutes. The only change, the only difference I could find, and there's maybe more, is on R21, on 220 on the Senate side it says that, and on 21.15 it says who. So you can see we're fairly close. That might not hold up the conference too much. That brings us to page R23, and there's a house provision in section 27 that I'll let Ms. Newman talk about.
Mr. Chair and members, the provision begins on the bottom of page R23, line 24.14. This was an amendment that was added on the floor that allows a person, if they're performing work at a resort, and the resort is either, it's classified as 1C or 4C under the property tax code and licensed by the Department of Health, they can do plumbing work without a plumbing license.
We have to go to R24, and there's sort of an odd-looking provision, section 28, section 5 on the Senate side. This is the independent contractor. This is sort of the beginning words, and it's going to be a recodified section that plumps a lot of definitions, and if you go later on, there's a revisor's instruction that's going to move language into that sort of a shell of a section there. Kind of confusing. Then section 6 on page R24, which is on 6.3, which is 24.22, it's lined up with it. It's pretty similar, but if you go to R26, it's a long statutory section, it adds an exemption from some boiler regulation to sawmill boilers. And this is fairly close. If you go down to 26.33 on the House side, the language after a condition is not replicated on the Senate side. The House has an expiration date on line 27.4, and then the House has some language in section 30 on 27.6 that maybe Ms. Newman wants to talk about.
Mr. Chair and members, as Mr. Fuller pointed out on page R26, line 26.33 on the House, the House has additional language that in addition to the remote alarms, there has to be an on-site alarm that will sound when a fault condition is detected, and it has to be audible to a distance of 500 feet. Mr. Fuller mentioned that the House provision would expire August 1st of 2016. And then at the bottom of R26 and over to R27, it directs the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to use money from the Construction Code Fund to update and modernize its boiler rules. And then the Commissioner has to make recommendations by October 1st of 2015 to the proper committees in the House and the Senate. On items related to boilers that operate higher than 15 pounds per square inch. And then, Mr. Chair, on R27, the House has an extra provision, a revisor instructions related to that apprenticeship conformity piece. And then I believe the revisor instructions on R27 and R28 are the same. And then the repealer section, John, did you incorporate the repealers in yours? Or?
Mr. Chair, we have the same revisor's instruction on R27 and Senate File 2124 that's sitting on the Senate floor. And the same is true with the repealers. They're in the apprenticeship bill. So just by eyeballing it, they look really darn close.
And that's a technical term, right?
Very darn close.
Very, very good. Very good. Well, thank you, Mr. Fuller and Ms. Newman. Any other comments to make as we go to side by sides? At this stage in the game, we could either look at same and similars, or else we could, if there is testimony here, folks would like to get into offering some feedback on any aspect of the bill. I want to make sure folks came to us today from great distances. They have an opportunity to weigh in. So. Happy to do that. Perhaps if somebody's here, Representative Mahoney, did you have somebody in mind or a section in mind that you wanted to make sure that we gave treatment to?
I know there's at least one person that wanted to speak to the boilers, and I know there's a couple others on
ORI provision. I would suggest that we take a look and listen to the boiler first. I don't believe they are the people who make money by hanging around here.
Fair enough. Well, I think that's a great piece of advice, and let's begin with the section that deals with the boilers. And Mr. Sprung would like to join us and provide some testimony in this section. And Mr. Fuller, if you would direct us to that R26 members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Mahoney, I appreciate it.
Welcome, Mr. Sprung. If you could state your name for the record, sir.
Reed Sprung.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. Please proceed.
Okay. When we heard about these amendments, both the rulemaking, at one time it was a study, and the exception for the boiler up north, there was an awful lot of people in our community, the boiler operation community, that were alarmed about different parts of this, and so we've talked to an awful lot of those people up to this point, and gotten a lot of opinions, and we've also sought out some opinions from some companies that manufacture some of the products involved and so forth. And I'd like to just kind of report to you what I've found, and maybe we can just go from there. My name is Reed Sprung again. I started out in this business in 1982. I was a nuclear reactor operator on a submarine in the Navy, and I've operated and managed a large number of boiler rooms since then. I run a company right now where we manage in some way or another about 300 or 400 different boiler rooms, both in Minnesota and throughout the country. So we have a good feel for what licensing laws and things like that are all over the place. We've seen as the controls have become more modern and that sort of thing, we've seen across the country, we went from about 40 jurisdictions that required boiler operator licensing and having those jurisdictions be less strict than Minnesota's typically would be, to today. This is from about 10 years ago until now. We now see about 61 jurisdictions, and the average jurisdiction out there is about as strict as Minnesota. I mean, even places like Arkansas and New Orleans and places like that seem to be having, we have some places like that have more strict laws than we do. I've personally been involved in changing or adding a few different statutes. The last three that I've been involved with increasing the amount of horsepower somebody could, the size of the boiler that somebody could operate with a given license, and things like that, where I'm increasing what a person can do or that sort of thing. So in other words, I'm not coming in and saying the sky is falling. I'm not that guy. I'm more the guy that's making it a little easier for business, a little bit easier for operators. I would like to talk mostly here, I think, about the controls issue. There seems to be some confusion on if we're going to set up new rules, and we're going to do that because the controls have gotten better, or we're going to allow somebody to not have to follow the same attendance laws that everybody else does, and then replace that with monitoring equipment. I'd like to speak to that just a little bit so you get an idea. Now, I've heard that that there's a plan to actually use an app on an iPhone to run a big biomass boiler up on the North Shore. If you're going to do something like that, it's useful to take a look at what would that be like if you had an issue going on. And not too long ago here, I had one of my employees over in Edina, and that employee was with a person that would be more of an apprentice sort of a person, and he was training him in, and they went to start the boiler. They started the boiler, they turned it, nothing happened whatsoever. And so my guy just kept looking for, what's wrong, why is this not, turning on, and he's checking all the switches that might normally be, tripped, for a situation like that and so forth. Now, if you were the person with the iPhone, you would have clicked and it wouldn't have started, and you'd still be clicking, and you wouldn't know what to do with it. Now, this guy kept doing his thing, kept looking, kept trying to figure out what was going on, and about 3 minutes later, he heard a click, 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 and he just dove for the off switch and shut that thing off as fast as he possibly could. Because what was supposed to be happening during that process is that that blower was supposed to be on full blast, pushing combustion products or unburned fuel out of the boiler. They call that a purge. And it was supposed to be doing that for several minutes. And at the end of that time, then that click, click, click happens, and the click, click, click is an igniter that's trying to ignite a fire within the boiler. Now, if you're the person with the iPhone, you're still going, why isn't this thing turning on? If you're the person that's on site where the people are who are near the boiler and so forth, you're shutting off the boiler so nobody gets in, you know, mixed in with a with an explosion. So you can see, you know, if you're trying to decide, do we operate a boiler with an iPhone, it's probably not a good call. And there is no real correlation between how good these new controls are and how much time we should spend in the boiler room. When you're looking at a boiler control, what you're looking at primarily is something that is controlling the boiler. And what the job of the boiler operator is to actually operate that control. You're actually switching it on, shutting it off, you're maintaining it, you're doing something to make sure that it works if it's a safety control, and so forth. The other issue that we have is that we have...
Representative Mahoney, have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Before you move off of the smartphone control comment. Now, in the bill, it calls for a manual restart. Is the only way that this would work. You can't use a remote start
right.
for the boiler.
Mm-hmm.
So could you comment to that a little bit?
Well, that's a common sense, safety, precaution to take, and I'd be all for doing that if you were going to do this in the first place, but. If you had the situation that we had that I just described, that manual restart wouldn't have done any good because what had happened is the control that prevents it from starting in the first place if there's a bad situation, that had failed. That's what the actual issue was.
Yeah, Representative Mahoney.
So, laptop, smartphone, wherever, 5 miles away, 10 miles away, boiler shuts down on control failure, but for whatever reason, high water cutout, low water cutout, gas, whatever. And it's got a manual reset.
Right.
Somebody has to drive there, go there, whatever, and actually flip the switch. So what is the safety... What could go wrong doing that? That's kind of what I'm trying to get to, is how does that create the problem? If it's an automatic shutdown and a manual restart.
Well, right now, that's all boilers, for all the redundant controls out there, all boilers already have the requirement to have a manual reset. So nothing would change in that regard. There's a few people over at the department that like to restate rules that you've got to follow anyway when you set up a new rule or set up a new statute. And that's what this is it's just restating, we're going to, like we always do, have a secondary, control, or we're going to have a manual reset or that sort of thing. So it isn't going to do anything regarding that, but that's actually a good thing. It's the fact that it won't catch everything. That's the whole issue. I have no problem with that in and of itself. Yeah, the example that I used from Edina, that didn't have, there was no requirement for a manual reset on that, either in the new statute or a new rule or in the existing rules, there just wouldn't be one. That wouldn't be something you could have a manual reset on. It's more of an active, constantly changing control that would do that. The I don't know if you all have these folders or not, but in the folders, I didn't want everyone to take my word for everything, so I thought we would call some people that we knew and see what they thought about the idea of having controls take the place of on-site operator time and things of that nature. And if you look at the stapled sheets that says quotes on the front of it, those quotes are from two different basic sources. One of them is from a manufacturer, and that's, well, several, one type is from manufacturers. One of them is from Hurst Boiler, which is the biggest, I think, the biggest biomass boiler manufacturer. And then on the back page, you've got similar, you know, people there. One, I think, is from Cleaver Brooks, I think, and another one, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is from PWS.
Rep. Sam Mahoney.
Before you go any farther, could you tell the committee how, what's the kind of roughly the percentage that the biomass boiler that you spoke to here, manufacturer here, how many, what's his or her percentage of the market? And Cleaver Brooks, what's their percentage of the market? Is it 10% of the market?
I don't have that information right at the moment. We've been out there to the vast majority of the boiler rooms in the state.
So the Cleaver Brooks, but not the I've not installed
The Hurst?
The Cleaver Brooks I've installed.
Yeah, Cleaver Brooks is probably more likely in Minnesota. Hurst, it might be more likely somewhere else. That's kind of, and as a matter of fact, we, I don't suppose I can mention the client's name, but we have a boiler that's built by Hurst in Minnesota that we operate. I've got a guy there right as we speak. So, and it's roughly the same size as the ones up north. So, then the other, there's, and that's the Bill Finn, operations manager, Sprung Services. That's our employee. That's the person I'm talking about is out looking at that. That biomass boiler at the moment. The top two people there, Stacy Cook and Doug Audette, they're both vice president level, you know, people at two of the biggest biomass plants in the state, and they're basically giving the same opinion that everybody else does. There's 31,000 boiler operators in the state of Minnesota. We've talked to literally thousands of them in the last few weeks. That we've gotten lots of calls back. We've gotten a lot of people getting a hold of us. The least cooperative ones were ones that couldn't believe that we were putting laws like this together, that this was actually happening. They absolutely don't believe it. I've even personally gotten on the phone and said, "Hi, this is I'm Reed. Yes, they're really doing this," and they'll just say, "You're full of it," and they hang up. I've gotten that kind of response because this is so kind of out there. But the Stacy Cook and Doug Audette, those two are, like I say, they're vice president level people. And then we have another guy that's the plant manager up at Fiberman in Benson. And that guy was a little bit more enthusiastic about his wording about it, but we didn't get his response until we were most of the way here today. So I didn't actually call these guys until over the weekend. So so that's that. Another interesting thing to look at in this thing is if you could find, I don't know if anybody can see this float, looks like there's a bunch of mud in there. That is what we call a boiler control, and that's a low water cutout. So the boiler operator's job is to make sure that mud doesn't get in there like that. He's got to check things, work on things. He's got to blow it down. He's got to check the sight glass. There's other things he needs to do to make sure that this doesn't happen. And if he's doing that from an iPhone or someplace like that, he can't possibly do that. The operator's job is to operate the controls, to interact with the controls. Another issue is when you shut off a biomass boiler, this big flame here, this is 7 feet by 20 feet long, roughly, and this is, you shut it off, and then later you take this picture, and it's doing this. It takes about 15 or 20 minutes before it burns completely down, and that's on one the size of the one up north. I don't know if it that one would be, you know, identical or not, but this was taken in the boiler that I was referring to a little bit earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Okay. Sprung. And you know, for the interest of our committee and also for the record, if you'd like to tie your comments to the language in front of us on R26, 24, 25, and
okay.
Just make clear your views on what's before us.
Sure. Can somebody, can I get a copy of that? Should have had that with me. Ask me a question directly on this, or?
Oh, I guess, you know, I was just...
We just want to know how you really feel about this particular amendment. So.
I've been paying attention to this for 2.5 weeks or so, and I've been paying attention a lot, so it's been a little tiring, a little, this is kind of the end of the whole thing, and it's like, I'm looking forward to going away. I'm not normally nervous speaking in front of people.
Well, you're doing great, Mr. Sprung. So
you guys,
thanks
you,
for
you guys are freaking me out. I'm telling you.
Oh no, you're doing great.
It's really him.
I'm not intimidating.
It's that tie.
Yeah, there you go. No, thanks for doing a great job, and I just appreciate.
Okay, would you like me to give you what my suggestion is here, or do you want to ask me questions, or
if you just like to crystallize your thoughts, and then we can allow any others who would like to weigh in here.
Okay, here's if in a perfect world. In my perfect world, if I could get you guys to just do whatever I wanted you to do, which I kind of doubt, I would change a few things. One thing I would do is I would say, okay, let's stop thinking about boiler controls and improvements in them as meaning automatically we can spend less time in the boiler room, boiler operators aren't needed. And let's stop making that general idea or the general assumption. Instead, if there's something specific to study, if there's something that we can look at and go, you know, we really don't need a boiler operator here for this specific reason, then fine, let's study that, you know, but let's not just say things are techier now, so let's get rid of people, you know. So that would be the first thing I would do. And then the second thing I would do is I would make a couple of changes to the code. Amendment. One spot here says is attended on site by a licensed boiler operator at least two times in a 24-hour period. If the boiler is not attended more than twice in a 24-hour period, the period between checks must not be less than 8 hours. Now, I don't have any answers to that. I'm just wondering if somebody can explain that to me.
Mr. Sprung, we typically do the question.
I don't mean that. It's rhetorical, yeah. Obviously. What I'm saying is, we should somebody should get rid of that, right? Doesn't that make sense that we should get rid of that? I mean, I don't even care if I mean it's. I'm not asking for anything unusual there. Just write it in a way that works. You know? Another one would be. Is not left unattended by a properly licensed boiler operator for more than two consecutive hours when the premises are occupied by the public. You guys don't have that. Not left unattended. Oh, and that, I'm sorry, this is based on another thing that I wrote. I guess the biggest thing is it refers to as remote monitoring or remote operations when it should be referring to remote monitoring.
Sure.
I would guess that whoever wrote this meant remote monitoring. But it says operating in there, which is a whole different ballgame. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. Maybe somebody really does want to remotely operate, but it's not recommended. Everything that I've given you guys in these folders with the quotes and all of that stuff, these are very high-powered people in this business that mm-hmm. they know what they're doing. They're very good. They're very smart. I got the smartest people I could find, and they are all saying, don't remotely operate. Monitoring would be fine. So I think that should be changed. And and then the other issue would be, I stopped at one point with this thing up north, and I thought, you know, if it was me, and if I was going to, I mean, how would I defend that if it was me? And I was going to say, okay, I'm going to set up a law like this, and I'm going to make up kind of a special, you know, rule for somebody. The best argument that I've heard from anybody was Representative Dill told me that, you know, he said, well, why should he have to pay for a border operator in the middle of the night when there's nobody there. And I thought, well, that's still not a good enough reason because there's people that live nearby and everything else, but it's the closest thing to a good reason that there is. So why not use it? Why not put it right in here that you're only going to remotely operate or remotely monitor and not have to have, you know, and excuse the person from having to follow the rest of the rules, the rules like everybody else. That's only going to apply when people are gone, when there's nobody there. And you could even throw in the two-hour thing from we've got another rule that has a two-hour time frame where you can be gone for up to that length of time. So we can allow the place to, even when there's people there, you can allow the person to be gone for up to 2 hours.
Sure.
And there you go.
Representative Mahoney.
I'm going to, because I think we have some other people that need to have a conversation, but I would like, would it be safe to say that you're not real favorable about this particular exemption for this boiler? And that's a yes or no?
Yes.
Okay.
That'd be
what
safe.
About, do you believe that it might be time to start taking a look at these so that people have a better... Because you've got a grocer, a teacher, a pipe fitter, why don't you do that? A banker and a farmer, right?
Insurance.
Insurance. Oh, probably. How about boiler insurance? making these decisions. So is it a valid time to actually spend some money as a state to look at this stuff? Or is that something that you think is probably not necessary? Technology hasn't come far enough?
I don't think the technology has come far enough to look at it in the way that you're suggesting, I think. I think that you can always look at everything if you have a specific thought. You know what I mean? Rather than saying, do you think it's time we start looking at buildings? You know, is it time we start looking at whatever? And just being very sweeping like that. Well, sure, you could, but you're just kind of fishing, you know? Mm-hmm. Think about something legit, so that's something specific that we can look at and say, okay, here's a legitimate thing to look at and to study, and we can decide, is this a good idea or not? Do we go this way or don't we? And then we come up with an answer. What kind of an answer could we come up with? If we sent this over to the Department of Labor and Industry right now and said, hey, look at boiler stuff and see what you think with the new things that are out, what's an acceptable answer to get back?
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Sprung, if there aren't any other questions among committee members, I may allow you to leave the podium. But if you'd like to come back, perhaps maybe we'll revisit this. Otherwise, thanks for your testimony on the matter.
I'm always available.
Thank you, sir.
I appreciate it.
Would anyone else like to speak to this provision, this section in the bill? Otherwise, Representative Mahoney, you said you had a couple other folks you were aware of that came here for...
I think it was the AURI issue.
Should we move in right to the top of the bill? I think it's Section 1 here, the AURI provisions, and this does come from the House language. If anyone would like to speak to the language here today, here's your opportunity. Hello, welcome.
Thank you, committee members. Dan Scogan, Government Relations Director for AURI. The board has asked me to just let you know that they are troubled with this language. They are in the process of making some adjustments to their board, and this kind of gets out in front of it. Senator Schmidt serves on our board, so he's kind of aware of some of the policies changes that have occurred or are occurring. Problematic in that it would really split our board into some who are under term limits and some who are not. We have not produced a letter yet, but I just got an email that this even makes our insurance company somewhat nervous as far as the directors and officers insurance that we carry, in that they're nervous about what that might mean in our governance. So just wanted to let you know it did not go through either of the ag committees in the House. We just would like it to go through the process, have it properly vetted, and would appreciate if this language did not prevail.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, Representative Mahoney.
So how long are you
Mr. Scogan, how long are your terms now?
Three years.
What's your proposed term limits?
Three threes, 9 years.
Oh, 9 years. So would that apply in retroactive, or is that just going forward?
I believe it's going forward.
So any of the board members, like Senator Schmidt here, could be on, if he was fortunate enough, the people of Red Wing were smart enough to keep sending him back here. He could serve on that board going forward 9 years more. You've been on it, what, 2 years? Or
it's my second year.
So he could serve a total of 11 years before it's all done.
I believe that's correct. And then if he took a three-year hiatus, he could be reappointed.
For another 9 years?
Yep.
Okay. And the terms, term limits, and they're all going forward. Okay. There's no question.
Any other questions? Representative Ward.
Senator Schmidt, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Scogan.
I appreciate you remembering that I was here once.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. I don't understand why it's going to impact. I heard you say it's going to impact your term limits on your board. Didn't I hear that?
Well,
did you say that?
Yeah.
How?
What we would have is a split board. We would have our legislative appointees would, of course, not have term limits. They would be appointed by the chairs of the finance committees. Then we would have Farmers Union and Farm Bureau would not have term limits because the language would allow Farm Bureau and Farmers Union to appoint whoever they wanted to. But then the members of the commodity groups and the ag banking groups would be under term limits. So we would have four that would not have term limits, and we would have five members of our board that would be subject to term limits.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Any other questions here? And Mr. Scogan, you had mentioned that this had not made its way through a board discussion or through either body in the Agriculture Committee in either body this year.
That is correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, first time board.
Thank you. For the indulgence. Is that the only reason that you're not in support of this? Are there any other? Are there any other reasons? Is the only thing that is problematic?
Well, part of the statute that we operate under, we get about 70% of our funding from the state of Minnesota. We are required to try to leverage that money and with commodity groups, foundations, and others. And we have a long established relationship with Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, commodity groups to do that leveraging. And we just, let me say, the board feels that this language may damage that relationship and to some regard in that it gives a higher status to some members of the board and it may become problematic in trying to leverage some of those funds.
Could it not foster a better relationship as well?
You would have, Representative Ward?
I just heard you say that it may damage a relationship. But isn't there a possibility that it also could enlighten, foster, and blossom the relationship to for a more positive outcome?
At 56 years of age, anything's possible.
Representative Gunther, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just out of curiosity, does the Farmers Union and Farm Bureau want to be on your board?
I believe they do. They have been on our board from the beginning, and we've had a good working relationship with them.
So what are we here for? If they're there now and you have a good relationship, why are we trying to put them on there?
Well, our current statute, as you can see, doesn't name them specifically. It names a statewide farm organization. This amendment would name them specifically.
Mr. Scogan, now as I understand, is it correct that AURA operates as an independent nonprofit and has a governing board versus an advisory board?
That's correct.
And so with that issue, if we have Farmers Union and Farm Bureau now being directed by their organizations and not by ARRI, we would now have four directors that would not in a sense, be under the responsibility of the organization from a director standpoint. So what would happen is you would have, I mean, typically the directors are responsible for governing this organization, considering that it is a governing body and not an advisory body. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, that's accurate. We are a governance board.
So if it's a governance board and we have 4 out of the 9 people that don't come up, that typically don't, they won't have to answer to that board. Is that not going to cause a problem?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, our board feels that could cause a problem.
And is that not why you're going to have a problem getting insurance? Because of the fact that you have 4 people on this board that don't really have to come under the governing section of the bylaws of ARI, which makes your directors and officers carrier very nervous.
Mr. Chair,
and very likely probably will not carry the insurance. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, having not seen the letter yet, I believe that is the concern of the insurance company that covers our directors and officers.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Scoglin.
Thank you, members.
Your testimony. Would anyone else like to speak to this element of the bill? And could state your name for the record, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we are supportive of the language. I haven't really had time to process the insurance matter that just came up. I'd say we've Farmers Union's always been supportive of our AURI. I've been very active in the board and working with AURI and hope to continue that. We feel like this language would clarify our role as it's been since the board started. And not sure I understood what Mr. Scoglin was saying and would like to visit with him about that, where he said that it was going forward now, not going back or looking back on the terms, because I have a different interpretation of that. I understand that what the board of directors adopted is affects you currently, not necessarily going forward. Those are my comments. So I appreciate your consideration, and I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And for the record, I would say that my understanding of the term limit resolution that was adopted by the board here in 2014 is consistent with your interpretation.
Okay.
I do believe it would be retroactively effective. Representative Mahoney, did you have a question? Or
I was actually to that. I was wondering if the board and some of its members we probably have to get back to the floor pretty soon.
Yeah.
So we'll be back here either tomorrow or Thursday to kind of hopefully wrap this up, but could the board and the Farmers Union, because I think the Farm Bureau also is in somewhat support, at least that's what I've been told.
He's here.
They're ready to come up.
Yeah.
If you could clarify how those term limits work in this particular issue, I think that might make our problem a lot simpler to solve.
Mr. Chair, I'll do that. Appreciate
it. I would like that in writing by from the board.
Okay.
Before I make any.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Okay. That's a fair request, Representative Mahoney. Yeah. Please, sir, if you'd like to provide some testimony. And again, if you could state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, my name is Doug Busselman. I'm with the Minnesota Farm Bureau. We didn't seek this amendment, but we do support it. I think that from our perspective, how the wording is worded, only from our interpretation, it just gives us the ability to make an appointment and to have that appointment be recognized as our representative on that. I don't know that we would have any issue with if our board member that was designated by us came up in a term limit situation, that we would not appoint someone new, and I don't know if that's what this language specifically implies, but we didn't see this as being an exemption around that term limit process. All we were looking at was that if we give if we give a name for our representative that we would like to have on there, which is really what the language has set up until now, that representative would be recognized and accepted by the board in terms of representing us on that. But we also believe that that representative should conduct themselves to the obligations of any director that would be responsible to AURI.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Busselman. Yes, Senator Dames.
Thank you. Mr. Busselman, so if this language would change so that right now the bylaws read, as I understand the bylaws read, that there will be two representatives of the farm groups. This would be specifically saying that Farmers Union and Farm Bureau would each be one of those two members. If the language was changed so that the appointed members still had to follow the rules as far as term limits and stuff like that of AURI and follow all the functions that are laid out by the Board of Directors of AURI, would you support that language?
We would not have a problem with that. Again, what we were mostly interested in, because there have been instances where we've named appointees, not to this specific board, but to other situations where we've based on our obligation to name a representative and then not had our that appointment wasn't recognized or accepted. And that's what we're after, is that if we have someone who's interested and qualified to fill that position, that we want that person to be that representative.
Sure.
And again, if there needs to be in the cycle of a term limit, and we need to appoint someone new, then we've got lots of people who would be qualified to fill that.
Sure. Well, thank you. I appreciate that perspective. And I should just add, I've been advised that typically how similar boards work in Minnesota is that it is the discretion of the board to name specific members. They may receive applications, they may receive recommendations, but this the language as it's currently written might set a precedent that could be applicable elsewhere. And I think, Mr. Busselman, you mentioned how in the past you've seen some of the names that you've put forth to various organizations perhaps not be accepted, and another member from the Farm Bureau be accepted in instead. And I think that's the concern that I've heard from a number of my colleagues with this provision, is that we would be going in a new direction in terms of giving, you know, your organization, you know, authority to name a specific person to the board.
And I don't mean to challenge, but the current law basically says the same thing. It just doesn't specify by name, but it's my understanding that it's always been the case that the two farm organizations are the two farm organizations. It's just that this spells out who they are.
And to be clear for members, when I say the name, I mean the name of an individual, not the name of the Farm Bureau or the Farmers Union, for instance. So nonetheless, I just wanted to share that with members, the concerns.
Thank you for your time.
Mr. Busselman, thank you for your testimony.
Would that be kind of like making an exemption for a 400 horsepower boiler?
Well, you know, I was
just wondering.
It's an interesting analogy.
You see, right, there's more came from one side of the chamber, from one side of the building than the other. But just my thoughts on the day.
Sure. And the concern I just share with folks is just the precedent that this could have in other organizations, and that we're not simply talking about AURI here, but rather a precedent that could be applicable for other organizations in Minnesota. So I think it would be instructive for us to take a step back and look at the broader picture, perhaps. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, thank you for coming to the table again, because I just really did want to ask a follow-up question on the concern of insurance or liability issue. A lot of us sit on a lot of different boards, and a lot of the rules of the board or the bylaws of the board or the bylaws of the agency or whatever are all applicable to what we do when we serve in that director position, no matter who we are, no matter what position we hold, no matter. So I really I don't see a concern of being able to get insurance or liability purposes, or the people that serve under the guidelines of board. You serve center under the guidelines of the bylaws of that organization, and if you violate that bylaws, then then there's repercussions or whatever. But no matter who you are, doesn't matter. I mean, every director, I assume, follows all the bylaws. So I don't follow the concern of the insurance of the insurance liability issue.
And I'd be willing to answer that if you don't mind.
Yes, Senator Dames, please.
The concern is that, as you put, if somebody's not doing something in accordance with the board, there are consequences. We'd remove the consequences because the board now does not have an option to remove them. They have no option to elect them. They have no option for term limits. They have no options. So the insurance company says, wait a minute, I'm not going to put directors and officers insurance out here when I have people that are coming onto the board that the board of directors, governance board, has no options to do anything with because they can't appoint them. There's no term limits. They have no control. That's where the problem comes about.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes,
so the suggestion that you offered, Senator, would cure that?
I'm saying that as long as they have term limits, and long as they meet the guidelines within the bylaws, and the bylaws are laid out pretty clearly in ARRI what they're looking for when they have somebody come on the board. And if their appointment meets the people that they're looking for on the board, it's not an issue. So when you take a look at ARRI and the things they're involved in, you would like to have somebody come to the board that has an understanding of the background of ARRI or the things they're involved in.
Senator, I thought I heard you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I thought I heard you offer to the Farm Bureau gentleman, I can't remember his name right now, and a suggestion on how perhaps that concern could be alleviated.
What that suggestion was, instead of having the language would read, instead of two farm organizations, we would change the language to Farm Bureau and Farmers Union. That's what that suggestion would be. Other than that, everything else would stay the same as in the bylaws right now. That would be a compromised piece of language.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, I have some language that was passed along to me. So, Senator Downs, if I read this to you, two members of a statewide farm organization, one member representing Minnesota Farm Bureau, and one member representing the Minnesota Farmers Union. Would that meet that? Or should we have legislative lawyers?
I think we need people to look at that because we need to make sure we defend the bylaws and the articles of incorporation of ARRI.
Yes.
And that's what we're really, that's where my concern is. I served on the board for a while, and I do have a real concern about how we lay this language out and what we take away from the board and how we may hamstring them in several areas. So I think we need to have that looked at to make sure if that's the way we're going to travel, to make sure that it's strictly changing just the names of the two organizations instead of having two farm organizations, it would specifically say Farm Bureau and Farmers Union. But after that is said, then we would follow the same procedures we do when the corn growers send us a name, when the wheat growers send us a name, soybean folks send us a name, they would follow the same protocol as anybody else does. That's what I would be asking for. And if that's something that those folks could live with, I think that's a possibility.
Mr. Chair, I came back to the table only to let you know that to Representative Mahoney's questions about term limits and Representative Ward's questions about insurance, I plan to have two letters available when we get together again. So.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Scully. That'd be very helpful for us as we continue deliberations. Would anyone else like to speak to this provision here on AURI? Anyone else like to? Otherwise, the purposes of today's discussion is simply to do the side-by-side and hear some testimony. And I was just curious if anyone else would like to speak. Representative Falk, would you like to speak? Or?
I'll offer one thing, Mr.
Sure.
Chairman.
Yeah, please.
And,
welcome to the committee.
Good to see you, Senator Schmidt and Mr. Chairman. And, you and I both serve on the board and just want to be clear, too, that we do partake there. But there have been letters that have come out from the organization that have not received full board approval. I know I have not been informed of some of them, and I don't believe that they've been sent to all board members, too. So just want the committee to know that any letters you get from the organization, take with a grain of salt, too. And to Senator Dame's point, you know, we do want people with long-serving experience, and, you know, unfortunately, I think that this term limit issue brought up because there was an effort to remove one member of the board. A long-serving member who has the audacity to ask simple questions like, can we see the check register? And how is the money being spent? And is this organization managed well? And unfortunately, sometimes when you ask tough questions, it riles some other people's opinions and thoughts on a matter. And this organization does need a lot of work. It's got some issues, operational issues. I know Senator Schmidt and I have had those discussions, and I think we have some agreement that there are some operational issues. But to remove somebody who is a long-serving member simply because they ask good questions about the finances, about the management, and about the direction in which the organization is heading is not a good cause for removal. So those are my comments that I hope to enlighten the committee.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Falk, Senator Dames, please.
I'd like to respond to that comment about putting on term limits to remove certain people. I take offense to that because I was the one that started this process of trying to get term limits in ARI when I was on the board. And quite frankly, Representative Falk, that had nothing to do with the people that are on the board. I've been on several boards for several years, and to me, term limits are common sense things to do. And when you give somebody 9 years, I think that that's a common sense. So I take offense to you saying that when I suggested term limits, I was going after somebody, because that is incorrect, and I want that on the record right now.
And to correct that, Senator Dames, you are no longer on the board, and this action was taken when you were not on the board. And so to your point is not relevant when we are actually, when the board has taken actions when you are ceased to be a member of it.
Thank you, Representative Falk. Any other questions or concerns? At this stage, what I'd like to do is just to continue to get some testimony on different provisions within this bill. And I know that we do have a provision here from Dolly regarding a contractor registration program that is recently served as a pilot program, and we have a little bit different language in the Senate and the House on this. It's in section 14. I do believe Dolly will be sending somebody up to speak to it soon. But if anyone else would like to speak to it in the meantime, yeah, please. And again, this is R14, section 14. All right, well, welcome. If you could
you.
State your name for the record, please.
I'm Jessica Luman, the Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm happy to answer any questions on this bill, on this portion of the bill. The contractor registration pilot project has been a project that has really resulted in about 13,000 building construction contractors being registered with the Department of Labor and Industry, and is being used as a tool to help us address the misclassification of workers as independent contractors in that industry. The side-by-side versions are very similar except for a couple of provisions, and frankly, we went to the House after we went to the Senate, and so we got more peace in the valley once by the time we got to the House, so we appreciate everybody working very hard on this through the whole process. There are several people in the room here who have been part of this process and have gotten us where we are today. The House version, while it makes the program permanent and it continues having the contractor registration program in effect, it does two things really to the benefit of the contractors who are really, in the department's position, is very much are really trying to do the right thing and trying to classify workers correctly, and we want to help them get in compliance with the regulations. And so the two pieces that the House version does, one of them, which is also in the Senate version, which creates a rebuttable presumption that even if a subcontractor isn't registered, they're still they're not your employee if they meet the traditional nine-factor IRS test of being an independent contractor. We recognize that independent contracting really is a legitimate business practice as well, but it can be misused.
Sure.
And then the provision that's different in the House from the Senate is that we have recognized that there were a lot of people who were trying to do the right thing and got a little bit caught up in hiring a contractor, a subcontractor who wasn't registered with us. And so we've created a provision in the House version that allows a forgivable penalty in the event that a contractor hires a non-registered subcontractor the first time they engage in that activity. Again, it's an outreach, education, and compliance approach as opposed to an enforcement approach.
Very good. Well, thank you, Ms. Assistant Commissioner Luman. Any questions among committee members? Well, thank you. Any additional testimony anyone would like to provide on this section within the conference bill? All right. Is there anyone out there who would like to provide any testimony on any other aspect of the bill? Thank you very much. Any other aspect of the bill that we have not talked about yet today? Please, we'll follow your lead. Let us know what you'd like to weigh in on.
All right. Actually waiting for Representative Mahoney probably wants to hear this.
He said he'll be right back. So,
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Joel Carlson, and I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I have long represented the Congress of Minnesota Resorts. I represent the small resort industry in Minnesota and have since the early 90s. And in 2008, the legislature passed a requirement relative to people performing plumbing work in towns of less than 5,000 people. And as that issue percolated, we didn't really pay attention to it as resorters because we're not in the business of plumbing. And as the issue percolated, it became clear that the department felt that requirement applied to resorters.
Sure.
By the time we made it through an understanding that it did apply to us, the window of opportunity to get a restricted plumber license had closed. The legislature did open it up for an additional period of time, but we've got about 900 resorts in Minnesota, and I would say or suggest that less than half of them carry this restricted license. And I would say without interfering with their rights of self-incrimination, I would venture to say that about all 900 of them are doing plumbing work on their property. And so we have a conflict here. Where we have a regulation that is not complied with, but it does increase the risk of a compliance problem when there may be an inspection. And so our association has tried to work with the department and others to get to a point where we can get back to where we thought we were, which is resorters are not in the business of plumbing, they're in the business of resorting. And when that toilet is clogged for your guest at midnight, you're not calling out a licensed plumber, you're just fixing the problem for your guests. And they do a significant amount of work on their cabins and their facilities in the fall and spring to open them up and drain them. And the chair is back, so now I don't want to get in trouble here with Representative Mahoney. And so we know the work is going on, and we'd like to have a resolution of this. And we've talked to the department. I had a chance to talk to someone from the pipe fitters, and you know whether it's.
No, wait a minute! Don't get me in trouble.
But the bottom line is this: is we'd like to have the issue resolved. Is the language that's in the House bill, which by the way our association supported but didn't really push on the House floor. Is that the perfect language? I think that gives more heartburn to the department than other iterations that we've gone through in the past where they could always get a restricted license or they could get some kind of certification. Just a blanket exemption, as is in the bill right now in talking with the department, I think gives them some real concern. They'd like to know that there's some level of competency that is that's going on for guest cabins and your property. And so we're willing to work with them to get to an ultimate resolution. I think Representative Mahoney is as tired of this issue as we probably are. And so that's kind of where we'd like to go.
More tiresome.
And as, you know, kind of like your AURI issue, we've talked to the department of trying to work this out through the interim, and if you want to put that in here in writing, that's fine with us too, but we'd like to get this resolved. And whether it's this language or not, resorters are going to do work on their property. That's just the business that they're in. They do a great job of it, and we'd like to have resolution of this.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any questions? Yes, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And full disclosure, I've been a seasonal, my wife and I and our family have been, I in particular, have been a seasonal camper since I was forever in my lifetime with my folks. But I have also been at a resort, seasonal camper resort, seasonal resort camper for the last almost 30 years. So I've been around resort owners, and being from the Brainerd Lakes area, you know, we have a few resorts up there. And, you know, so I hear from them frequently. And I always like to just watch my resort owner and what he does every day, you know, and what he doesn't do and what he's capable of and what he's not capable of. And you know, although he in particular is capable of many, many, many things, I also know that he also goes out and seeks official plumbers when they are...
I am not a plumber. I am not a plumber.
There's a pony, I didn't see you were. I just wanted to, you know, reference you as, you know, one of those kind of folks that deal with that area, okay? Professional in that area. But having said that, you know, when I need... matter of fact, members, on the House floor, we had a good solid... vote on this on the House floor in our House position, and I'm going to be fighting for this House position because I think it's important for the tourism industry. And I referenced a bill that I carried back in 2000 and I think it was 7 or 8. I don't remember. It was called the Backflow Preventer Bill, and those of us that were here at that time know that was a pretty contentious bill, and with Dolly and with the Department of Health, and it was about, you know, we've got to do this right, using this piece, this backflow preventer, rather than this backflow preventer. And the two did the same thing, but one was several hundred dollars and one was $15. And they were both capable of, and have since been proven to show that the more economically priced piece works. And so, you know, we had thousands of mom-pa resorts in this state of Minnesota, this great state of Minnesota back when, and they are operating on a shoestring budget and a tight profit line. And so anything we can do to help the tourism industry, you know, is important to the whole state of Minnesota, not just a particular piece of Minnesota. So, you know, I just think that allowing resort owners to do a washer repair or unplug a toilet or... you know, fix a pipe or whatever it is, it would be no different than me doing something in my house to be able to fix it, or a small business owner also who also should be able to fix some of their own local plumbing issues as well. So I just wanted to make that kind of statement in support of the House position here, although I know we're not taking any positions right now on it. You'll be hearing from me in the future on this as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Ward. And Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, just to the language itself, just so that you know, that this exemption only applies to someone who is an owner or operator of a resort performing work on the resort property. And the classification, the property tax classification of 1C, 273.1C, is an owner-occupied resort. They live at the resort, and it has to be on Lakeshore. Of those of our members, the average resort has 10 units. So we're talking about, you know, operations where they do everything at the resort. And a 4C resort is similar, except it doesn't have to be owner-occupied. And those resorts, that's the difference between the two. And they also have to be licensed by and hold a license by the Department of Health. And what's important about that is that it's the Department of Health that actually approves the plumbing plans that resorters submit for their facilities. And so you have to have, you know, your plans approved by the Department of Health, you're licensed by the Department of Health, and you're only doing this work on your property. And that is, we think, a pretty significant restriction of what you can do. The restricted plumber's license that some of them have right now would actually allow them to be plumbers anywhere they want, so long as it's under 5,000 people. And that's not the business that we're in, but that's how this current regulation is written. So hopefully we can get this resolved and we don't have to talk about it when they have their day on the Hill next year. So that would be our goal. So
thank you, Mr. Chair. Any additional questions? Would anyone else, for today's hearing, what we're doing is just hearing testimony on various provisions of the bill. We expect to adjourn here momentarily. If there are no other comments or questions, testimony folks would like to offer for the record. Otherwise, I think the plan here would be to adjourn and allow us to get up to our respective floors here. Oh, Mr. Rakowski, yes.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Senator and representative and other distinguished members of the body, we have been working with the Congress of Resorts over the years. As he said, we opened the window for this restricted plumber license not once but twice. However, the commissioner wishes me to tell you that the way this language is in the bill now, we're opposed to it. As Joel, unless I'm reading the, you said owner occupied, if you would, the way I'm reading that, our people are reading that, that would include places like Cragen's and Madden's. And I think we're trying to get, deal with the quote mom and pop. So, but it just in principle, this language, we don't like this language. However, we're committed to working this out for a final resolution once and for all with the stakeholders, and we plan to bring them together during the interim. So I wanted to be on the record to say that.
Very good.
And if I might just...
Representative Mahoney.
I could try to add a lot to this particular conversation about sure things that I would like in this particular conversation, but my goal, my hope is that the pros at the department and the Department of Health get together to figure out how best to serve and make this issue never to grace this marbled hall again.
Amen. Thank you, Mr. Not on our watch. Thank you.
So we're looking for a productive interim on this matter, and we'll be back next year. If there is no additional testimony initially here today, we will adjourn, and we'll plan on coming back here hopefully in the next day or two to wrap up this bill, do same and similars, and then adopt provisions from one house or the other. So with that, the committee is adjourned.
I hope everybody reads up a little bit on the order.
That's right. That's right. All right.
Yeah.
I'm going to head to the floor and see if we can get a report done by the floor.